in the hand, and we're going to have Jonathan for our warm-up speaker.
I think this is about right.
Okay. I'm a grateful alcoholic, and my name's Jonathan Toledo.
Hi, Jonathan.
And those weren't words I said when I first got here. And I know the steps work today because I practice them, you know, in my everyday life as well as in the rooms. And for some reason, when I did the 12 steps, the fourth time in my life I tried AA, it worked. Because I know what it's like to come in here and not do the work, and it's very short-lived for me, from my experience. I'm the kind of alcoholic that I could take a drink right now and, you know, and load up everything I care about, you know, and kiss it goodbye because it all goes on the back burner, you know. My brain can put everything I care about in the corner of my head and throw a sheet over it, you know, and I can exhaust, you know, every resource I have and waste all my time with people that I think are close to me or family, you know, at the time. But they're really people that just want to keep me sick. And I never really realized, you know, I was sick. And it took me a long time to really to figure out what was wrong with me, you know. And I could come to terms with the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And for some reason, when I finally realized that my life was unmanageable is when I realized I had to do something different. I had to, like, I had to be wrong 1,000 times, you know, in a row, and keep banging my head against the wall before I could realize, you know, this is not getting me anywhere. And I kept trying, you know, to hang on to one thing, and it just always lands me back, you know, on my back. And I have a home group today, you know, I have a sponsor. I always like when people say my sponsor knows he's my sponsor. Because that's important, you know. But I got a sponsor that made me do the work, you know. He made me come to his house. He didn't make me, but, you know, if I didn't bring something that I was supposed to bring, he'd tell me, you know, you're not doing it for me, you're doing it for you. And if I don't do it right, you know, or to the best of my ability, I'm just selling myself short. And that's the truth today, you know. I did a bunch of things in early in sobriety, and I still do things today, like speaking like this in front of people. I don't know what it is. I've done this a bunch, and every single time I get so nervous right before they say my name, and it just doesn't get easier. I don't know why, but anyways, everything I've done in here that I didn't want to do, I grew, and everything I cared about that was basically gone came back. I got people and friends that made in here. You know, it talks about in the Big Book, I've made relationships in here that are unique and priceless, and that is like an understatement today for me. Like people I know, I have some problems with, my mother's sick right now, you know, and we found out she had breast cancer, but I have friends in here that call me to ask me how she's doing, and they want an update, and if they can do anything, you know, and nobody else I used to hang out with was calling me about that. And you know, I'm working on year 3 right now, and it's the best yet. I think my second year was harder than my first year, to be honest. But I've figured out the more meetings I go to, the better I feel, and the better things go. The more I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, things work out. The more I trust my higher power, everything works out really good. You know, I have to surrender every day. And step 3 was big for me, turning my will and my life over to the care of God. Because when I try to run things, everything ends up tits up, you know. And for some reason, I'll still put my hand on the steering wheel sometimes when I know it's going to end up like that. I do that every day. I surrender, and I come to the terms with the fact that I am an alcoholic. And if one of those thoughts comes through my mind and I'm spiritually fit, you know, it gets like kicked to the side real fast, and I know exactly where it's going to get me, you know. Time and time again, I've let people down, but ever since I got in here and did the work and kept doing, you know, fighting the good fight in AA, I haven't let anybody down. I'm not perfect, you know, and if I do, I mean, I'll make it up to them, you know, but I keep my word today, you know, hang on, drawing a blank right now.
You're okay.
But this is the easier, softer way for me. I'm the kind of alcoholic that, you know, misplaces a full-size pickup, you know. I come out of a blackout, walking on Mooney Boulevard, don't know where my truck is, you know, and it's 4 a.m. and people are doing the yard work on Mooney. That, or I wake up in an accident, you know. I've done that twice. And I didn't really, you know, I didn't understand it until I read the book. And I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving and how, you know, really, even though I wanted to be certain places, I was fighting, you know, to overcome a craving that was beyond my mental control. And that's the truth for me today. And in my experience, like, and it's all experience that was right in front of my face for so many years. And it could have happened yesterday, you know, but I could justify it today that it's going to be different or know exactly what's going to happen and do it anyway, because it's what I want to do. And I don't know, just things go so good for me when I do the work here. I got into service because everybody in my home group was talking about service. So I came in one day and asked for a service position, and then I got another one. And even when I don't want to go do my commitment and I do it anyway, I leave there feeling good. You know, it comes out of left field, and I'm like surprised every time. And I have that experience too, but I'll forget it and be like, oh man, I gotta go open the meeting and make coffee, you know. And then I'm making coffee and I'm feeling good, you know. If you make it, they will come. That's what I say. But and then now, you know, the ultimate thing here is being able to help another alcoholic and to give this thing back the way it was given to me freely. Not everybody I work with stays sober, but you get a few guys that they do everything you tell them to do, and you get to watch their life change for the better. And you get to see things happen for them. And, I mean, that's the greatest gift I've gotten here. Besides that, my family, you know, I have a fiancé that's willing to marry me and let me annoy her for the rest of my life. But that's all stuff I can't have when I'm out there. It's stuff that, it's not important to me, you know. I got to buy her dinner before this, you know, and that's not something I would have done, you know, when I'm out there. I might have told her I would, but I wouldn't have came through. Yeah, even though I would have really, really wanted to be there, you know. But that's the truth for me. I mean, I'm so grateful today in everything in my life. And when I practice these principles outside of the rooms, every situation I'm in, you know what I mean, goes good. I mean, I like being of service because, you know, my friend Tommy there talks about being of service because it takes you out of yourself. And that's what it does. It gets me out of my head. Because if I spend 5 minutes, you know, just thinking about me, it's not going to end well. And I mean, that's what I'm here to help today. And I enjoy helping others, you know. And I'm Jonathan, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. Come on, let's have a big hand for Jonathan. Okay, folks, it's time for our main speaker. Our main speaker tonight is Mr. Louis. And let's give Louis a big hand.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Louis Thompson, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Louis.
My sobriety date is December 8th, 2015. And my home group is the Men's Stag meeting in Visalia. So I am an alcoholic, and I don't say I'm an alcoholic because I had a drinking problem. I'm an alcoholic because I belong to a class of people who are a different entity. So I've learned, you know, when we take a drink, you know, there's something abnormal about our mind and our body, and there's a reaction that happens. You know, we take a drink, and we develop what's known as the phenomenon of craving. And so we take a drink, and we want more. And the second part of that, you know, is once I take that drink, and I develop that phenomenon of craving, then I get that mental obsession that just, you know, no matter what, it's always on my mind, and I can't stop. So, let's see here. I'll try not to, you know, when I was about 9 months sober, Bill asked me to go and chair the meeting at the ice house, and I feel like I bombed it, I don't know. But I did this whole outline, and I had all these, like, readings that selected and everything from the book, and I thought it was pretty terrible. I listened to it one time, and I was like, yikes, you know. But, I believe that I've always been an alcoholic from the time I was born, you know. And, you know, I believe there's people that, you know, might be alcoholics that don't even drink. You know, I've seen a bunch of people that are selfish and pig-headed and have no regard for anybody else except for themselves, except they don't drink, you know. But, you know, me, from a young age, you know, I was always different, you know. I was always conniving. I was always manipulative. I was always planning everything, you know. I'm a master manipulator, and I work really hard not to do that anymore. You know, I recall the first time that I felt the effects of alcohol. I was probably about 6, and I'm a good alcoholic mixture. My mother was born in Ireland. My father was born in Mexico, so. Yeah. You know what that's like. But, you know, my cousin Jim, I believe I was 6, and it was his wedding, and good Fitzgerald wedding, and everybody was getting, you know, drunk, and I had the honor of manning the keg for, you know, the time. So everybody would come through the line and their cup, and I'd pour it out, and, you know, I'd just, hey, what does that taste like, you know? Oh, take a sip and try it out. So, you know, I did that, and every little bit, you know, every intermittent time, I'd say, hey, what's that, you know, what's that taste like? Oh, yeah, just try it, you know. So I started to get, you know, feel the effects of alcohol, you know, got feeling a little funny, and, hey, this is pretty cool, you know, and I, you know, kept pressing my luck, and eventually someone was like, you already tasted it last time I came through, you know, and I'm like, shit. So, you know, I recall that night, I got that warm, fuzzy feeling. I felt great. It was a good time. You know, I got on the dance floor, you know, little kid. And I'm told that when I was little, I had this dance that I do, like a hip swing kind of dance. I don't know. But I don't recall it. But, you know, I just had a good old time. And the next morning, you know, when I woke up, I felt like shit. You know, I had a headache and all that kind of stuff. And my mom was pissed at me. And but overall, it was a good experience, you know. And I continued, you know, from a young age through, you know, through to adolescence to, you know, in retrospect, to exhibit all the characteristic of alcoholism, you know. I manipulated people. I've always been, my whole life, like I said a little bit ago, a chronic planner, manipulator, you know, and that looked like is, you know, from a young age, I would think about interactions in advance, you know, and I'd kind of fantasize about them and say, okay, so how would this work, you know, about getting people to do what I wanted. I didn't even realize that's what I was doing, but, you know, I'd, you know, dream about, oh, yeah, how does it go? And then once it came, you know, I'd talk to them, and I try out different things, and that didn't work, and so the next time I try something else, and then, you know, I just, you know, always got my way. You know, my mother passed away when I was 11. So, you know, she had been sick for a while, and, you know, she was in the hospital, and then she got feeling better, and then she came home, and then it was a couple weeks later, you know, she passed away in her sleep. You know, and my dad, he's a good dad. He's always been there for me. And I remember everybody always like, man, your dad always looks like he's pissed off. And I don't know why, but, you know, and I guess that was me. But, you know, he took care of us really well. He went to work. He was a mechanic, and he made sure that, you know, my brother and I were provided for. But he kind of just let us do whatever we want. And so after my mother passed away, I started to, you know, get more and more crazy. I recall that my little brother, he's 4 years younger than me, and, you know, 11, 12, we would go, you know, once it was summertime, it was just us. He'd go to work. And so my dad always had bottles of whiskey, and he smoked the nastiest cigarettes that we loved him. He was a GBC menthol light 100 smoker. Yeah. So my brother and I would steal a pack of cigarettes, because he always had cartons, you know. He's like a 3-day pack smoker, he was. And then we'd get his whiskey, and we, you know, pour some out, and then we put water in it. And he never said anything about it, not once. And I know he had to notice, because I recall times that we poured one, and we're like, God, what? This is shit, you know, it was all weak. Well, he still never said anything. You know, and so, you know, we lived out in the country by Reedley, between Reedley and Parlier. And, you know, I started to get in trouble. You know, at school, you know, I you know, God bless me, you know. School's always been really easy for me. You know, I am able to take in information, it just sticks. You know, and so, you know, I grasp concepts, math, and all that kind of stuff really easily. And so, like, growing up, you know, I'd be in class, and they'd give you the assignment, and I'd be done in, like, you know, a minute. And then I'd be in the back making fart noises and stuff, and they're just like, oh, get out of here, you know. So, those things started to happen, and it wasn't really my dad, but my cousin Lori, she had kind of come down to stay with us for a little bit after my mom passed away, and so they made a suggestion that I needed to go to Boy Scouts. And so all the, like, we went to this country school, Riverview, over by Reedley, and it was all a bunch of farmers' kids and, like, field worker kids, you know. And we were definitely not farmers' kids. We weren't field worker kids, but we, you know, lived about like that. And so I recall, you know, not feeling as good as these farmers' kids, because, you know, they had everything. And when we started, I started in Boy Scouts, the Scoutmaster was, he owned a big packing house. Like, his son was in my class, and I'd go over to his house, and they had this big old huge house, and then behind was this huge packing house, like in their backyard. And so, you know, we did all this kind of stuff, and I recall that we were working on the cycling merit badge. And so, it was, I don't know how none of us ever didn't die, but, you know, they take us up to the mountains, and we, like, ride down from, like, Squaw Valley, down 180 and stuff. And the first time we went, I didn't have a bike, and, you know, I got this. I got to use the Scoutmaster's wife's bike, which was a ladies' beach cruiser. It was terrible, you know, and everybody else is on these, you know, diamond bags and these, you know, high-dollar mountain bikes, and I was just like, God, this is fucking shit, you know. Oh, excuse me. But I just felt so inadequate, so terrible, that I had to do whatever I had to do to get myself a bike, you know. And there was this really nice bike shop in downtown Reedley, and I go in there, and, like, they had, you know, it was just like, oh, this GT mountain bike, triple triangle, this, like, it was the bee's knees, you know. And so I talked to the owner, and I was like, okay, you know, how much is this bike? And they're like, oh, no, that's $600. And this is, like, in, you know, the mid to late 90s, so $600 was a lot of money, you know. So I was like, well, you guys take payments on it or whatever? You won't sell it? And the guys were like, yeah, whatever. Oh, yeah, we'll do it, you know. And so, you know, at the age of 12, when I wasn't, granted, at this time I was not drinking. I was not doing anything other than being me with alcoholism, I believe, you know. So I devised this plan. You know, there was a store, you know, a couple blocks down from the bike shop, and they had the sign in the window that says, we buy Levi's. And the first one that I got, my father, I recalled in my memory that my dad had a stack of these Levi's that he got for Christmas, so I grabbed a pair, and went down there, and they gave me like $25 for them. So, all right. And so, over the course of, I think it took me about 3 weeks, I devised a plan to acquire Levi's at various locations within Reedley. And I know that the guy who owned this clothing store had to know what the hell was going on. I mean, a little 12-year-old kid going in there with brand new Levi's and stuff and just cashing out. You know, and it didn't take me but I think 3 weeks or so when I had that, you know, that bike, you know. And I felt so good, you know. You know, all the little extras, the little pump that, you know, the highest tech little pump that went underneath, and the little brackets for your shoes to go in and shit. And I was like, what now, farmer kids, you know? And I felt so good that my bike was actually better than all of theirs, you know? And at that point, you know, I knew that there was something wrong with me and that I had to do whatever I had to do in order to feel better, you know. I had to con or do whatever I could in order to have better stuff so that I could prove to people that I was better than them because I felt way below them, you know. And that's just, you know, I'm an alcoholic as described on page 21 of this book, you know. I do tragic and absurd things when I'm drinking. Shit. I do tragic and absurd things when I wasn't drinking. You know, I mean, a few years later, you know, I had already been, you know, I was a really good athlete. You know, I wrestled from a young age. My freshman year, I went to state in wrestling. You know, I played football. I was on the varsity team my freshman year, which is not heard of. And, you know, as soon as sports were done, I was done. You know, by that time, I was full swing in criminal activity, you know, drinking on a daily basis, smoking left-handed cigarettes, and, you know, selling all those other things that, you know, aren't part of this program. But, you know, I was just made myself into this, you know, this person that, you know, made me feel good, you know, that was powerful, that was respected. You know, from a young age, you know, at this point, you know, I'm looking up to all the wrong places, you know. Little kids usually have, like, heroes like Superman and Batman and stuff like that, but, you know, the ones that I looked up to and I thought were, I'm going to be like that guy, you know, they had these big mustaches, they're tatted up, you know, and they were just getting out of prison, and they walked into the room, and everybody's like, oh. Oh, that's what's the name, you know? And it was like, oh, shit, you know? I'm like, sign me up, that's me, you know? That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, I proceeded to do that. You know, I got myself into trouble over and over and over. You know, I was selling, I know, my whole life, you know, I've been a low life pretty much. I've been a street pharmacist. That's my main, I didn't have an actual job until I was like, I don't know, until like, 2007 was like my first real job. And so I get kicked out of school, high school, my freshman year. Well, I get suspended the last day of school. So I was suspended for the first 4 days of the next year. And the first day I went back, then they just kicked me all the way out, you know. And so at that point, we got kicked out of our house in Reedley because I was growing these little plants that they don't appreciate. And, you know, we moved out to Goshen, and that was what's up, because everybody's there, and I knew, it was just, you know, crazy. And they decided at some point, I was going out to this little court school in the country, Packwood, and they decided, hey, you know what? Send Louis over to Corcoran to the rock program. You know, and granted, you know, I'm getting loaded and everything, but when this happened, you know, I was completely sober. You know, so they take us into, I had long hair, like Rick did at the time, and I was a badass, so I used to, you know, pull it back, and I'd put these four red rubber bands in there, you know, and so I go in there, and they're like, what the fuck is this? You can't have this, and they made me take my hair out, and I'm walking through there, and everybody's like saying, oh, yeah, okay, motherfuckers, you know. And so it was like this typical scared strength thing. They took me through B-Yard and Corcoran, which come to find out, I end up there like 15 years later, but so they go through, and then they take us to like the program office, and they got these lifers to come in, and they're all in your face, and they're like, oh, you motherfucker. And then the guy got in my face, started yelling, and I fucking punched him right in the nose, started bleeding. I get arrested in Corcoran State Prison by the Kings County Sheriff's Department for assault. And, you know, I don't know why my dad always looks pissed off, but he had to come and pick me up, you know, from juvenile hall in Kings County for this, you know. I wasn't drinking at the time. You know, I was just, this guy disrespected me, you know. Doesn't he know who I am? You know, and that's the story of my life, you know. I got into trouble, always. You know, I don't know why, but, you know, it was just a cycle that kept repeating and repeating and repeating. You know, I ended up going to a group home in Exeter, and they would cart us down to the Lano Club. I was actually one of the first residents that was there when they opened the place. And they cart us down to Lano Club, and I remember hearing names, so I saw like Johnny Mack down there, and I saw Luger down there, you know, and I saw, you know, and they tell us, take a good look at these guys. You know, they'd be like, they had the Suburban, they take us over there, and when you get out of here, take a good look at these guys, because this is going to be you if you keep doing what you're doing, you know. Like, you're going to be me. And so, you know, I stayed there, and I just, you know, life, I just continued doing the same things. You know, I got out of there, continued to do the same things, and it wasn't, you know, within a year, I was already cut. They got me. You know, I got, you know, arrested doing my profession. I got arrested with 3 pounds of, you know, that powdery stuff. You know, and I that's what really started my full cycle, my alcoholic life cycle. You know, I got it. So, you know, I was involved with a lot of stuff. You know, I had some family members from my Mexican side that were involved in manufacturing, and I was into that, and so, you know, I got arrested, bailed out, got a lawyer. The lawyer says, okay, so you're going to go to Pine, and we're going to get you in Pine. I went into Pine Recovery when I was 18 years old, and I didn't do a damn thing. I just was there because the lawyer said, you know, go there. It's going to look good. The judge will have some leniency on you. You know, by the time it was all said and done, like, you know, a year and a half later, still went to prison. And I was still crazy, you know. I felt like I've arrived, you know. You know, when I was in there with all the main low lives, you know, and I got to Delano, I walk in there, and I'm like, yeah, man, I made it, because, you know, that's what I aspired to be. You know, I aspired to have that name. That's when someone said, oh, I'll reveal. So, not my proudest moment, but I have a name that everybody called me in the streets, and I was referred to as Lucifer. Thank you. And the way that name came about, well, I was just out of my mind, and it was probably 3 o'clock in the morning, and I thought somebody was chasing me in an alley in Exeter, and I was shooting at him, and everybody came out, and there was like nobody there, and I was just like so psycho, and I look over, and I'm like, god dang, he was like a devil, freaking Lucifer, man, and it just stuck from there, you know. And so I get to Delano, you know, I'm 18 years old. No, actually, no. Probably 19, about to be 20, you know. And just went in there and said, hey, put me in, coach. And I did whatever I had to do to make a name for myself, you know. And I recall the day that I turned 21. You know, I was in San Luis Obispo. And it was a pretty cool day, temperature-wise, you know, but I was in the hole at CMC, you know, for I just got in a riot like a couple days before that. And so it wasn't the San Luis Obispo that you guys are expecting. No, that's just, it was normal to me to live like that. You know, it was normal to be the guy that, like, well, nobody ever brought me home to meet their parents, you know, but if they would have, they'd be like, no, you know. That was me. You know, I love that. I relished in that because, you know, I had that feeling now that, you know, whenever I'd be out, I would have money. I would have cars. I would have everything. And I would feel superior. But I would always feel alone. I always feel terrible. And I'd always just get loaded, you know. I didn't really suffer from hangovers that much because I found out that if you don't go to sleep, you don't get a hangover. But that takes a toll on you. And I, you know, by the time I got out of prison, you know, I was like, whatever. So I got out, and I recall my parole officer, Garner Hoffman, and he said, you can smoke pot till your eyes go cross, but if you do anything else, you're going back. I said, all right, you know. And so I didn't understand, you know, I thought, oh, yeah, I know I got a problem with that other stuff, so I'm not going to do that, but I'm not an alcoholic. You know, so just started drinking, you know, with all the homies and everything. Yeah, hey, what's up, man? You know, throwing the barbecue, start drinking, and I didn't know what was going on, but, you know, I just wanted to keep drinking. And then once I got drinking, you know, things progressed, you know, and before you know it, I was right back there again, and I was getting, you know, they were looking for me. And so I showed up and said, hey, you know, I need to go to a program. And so there it is, you know. My process was complete. Get in trouble, go to a program. Wait till the heat died down. Get back out, do it again. You know, I ended up not getting a violation. I went to the program, went to the PAR center. I just stayed there for 13. Well, it was already like 2 months by the time I got there. So I stayed there for another 11 months. Discharged my parole in 13 months, free and clear. You know, I could do anything. And I don't know, it wasn't 9, 10 months before I had another number, you know. Same thing, just that, well, guns and all that other stuff. And, you know, just the same thing over and over and over, you know. It's how it progressed for me. You know, and then I finally paroled off my second term, and I told myself, oh, man. You know, okay, so I was in Solano. No, my second term was in Corcoran. So I had this celly, and he was like 70. And he was that, you know, the guy that I looked up to when I was a little kid. I was probably the same guy or his cousin or something. Because he had that big old bro shop, but it was all white, you know, and he was all tatted up, and he had tattoos all over his head and shit. And he's like, oh, man. You know, he came into my cell, and he's like, oh, I'm back home, man. I just went on vacation for a few weeks. You know, I did some stuff, and I got some bitches, and I'm back home, you know. And I'm thinking, holy shit, man. You know, I kind of had this aha moment. I was like, man, no. That's not going to be me. You know? That's not going to be me. And so, you know, I paroled off that second term, and I had got arrested in Fresno County. And so I had to parole to Fresno County. Well, I didn't know it. I didn't have any place to go. I paroled with a white t-shirt, PIA, and some khakis, PIA, and I had some jet flaps, you know, and $200 gate money. You know, my dad picked me up over at the Amtrak station in Corcoran, and it was like, hey, you know, what are you going to do? I was like, I don't know, I'm going to stay here tonight, you know, and I, because it was Thursday, and I knew that if I went out Thursday, they'd find some place for me to go, you know. So I went. I waited till the next day, and I reported at like 4:45 to the parole office on a Friday afternoon. And they're like, oh. I said, where are you going to go? I don't know. No, I don't have an address or anything. I'm like, shit, you know. And so they put me up in a hotel for the weekend, and I, you know, it was cool. And that Monday, you know, I got the escort to the luxury resort called Turning Point right there on G Street. Oh, man, it's beautiful there. The yard in Corcoran was nicer than this place. You know? And so, no, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm not like these other people here, you know. Don't they know who I am? And so I just did the same thing I did. I programmed, you know. I did what I've been taught to do. When you're on the inside, you do certain things, you know. You don't mess with that stuff. Cause, you know, well, the people that I run with in there, if you mess with that stuff, you're going to get whacked. So, you know, that'll let you, that'll put a little get up and go into your, not doing the bad things. You know, and so I did that. And I had met my beautiful wife, you know, earlier before when I was batshit crazy, but luckily for her, we didn't, you know. So it was on MySpace at the time. I saw her and I was like, oh, hey, what's up, you know, and I hit her up and, you know, we started dating and, you know, I got a job, my first real job ever, at a call center right there in Fresno. And, you know, I started just as a, it was a customer service call center. And, you know, I started calling people, oh, how was your service for Audi, you know, this and that. You know, and about 6 weeks later, you know, I've always had a natural ability for, I don't know, leadership or what, but, you know, 6 weeks into it, you know, I was a supervisor already. And things are going good. And I wasn't getting regularly loaded, you know. I was still, when I go home on the weekend, you know, I, you know, go on a pass to, with my girlfriend at the time, because, you know, and I, you know, I'd drink and stuff, and didn't do anything crazy, because I knew I had to go back and continue, you know, I had to get off parole, you know, in 13 months. So, you know, by the time that was all said and done, I did that, you know, and I, somewhere along the line, I said, you know what, I know what I need, you know, and it was a twofold thing. So I need to go to school and get an education so I can get a real job and make real money. But that wasn't my true motivation. You know, my true motivation to get an education was because my family thought I was the biggest piece of shit in the world. And if I got an education and got a degree, I could say, what the hell? You know, I just wanted to stick to my family. That was the whole motivation. That's, you know, more insanity, you know. And so, you know, once I was done with parole, you know, I moved down with my wife. You know, I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. And, you know, things were good. You know, they weren't. I still, you know, after we had, you know, there's this stuff called computer duster. And when I was in the group home as a little kid, you know, I used to clean out the office and stuff, and I'd take out the trash and I'd throw one in there, and we'd be upstairs and we'd be getting loaded with this stuff, you know. And you know, I was going to school and everything, and I don't know what it was that compelled me to do this, but I recall I had it in my hand one day, and I said, man, I remember what this stuff does, you know. And I had this thought. So this is not a good idea, you know. But I used it, and I got loaded with it, you know. And she found out about it, and I know it really hurt her. And, you know, I was able to, you know, to make her think, okay, things are good, you know. And, you know, we got married. I was going to school, I was working, and things were going right, you know. You know, I spent about 2 years, well, a little less than 2 years at PC, and I got my bachelor's. And I transferred to CSUB, and 1 year from then, I got my bachelor's. No, I got my associate's at PC. Transferred to CSUB, got my bachelor's. A year later from that, I got my master's. And while I was there, I was able to manipulate my way into a company that I thought would be a pretty good fit for me. You know, they're, you know, it was an agriculture organization, a grower association, you know, and they're doing a lot of business. And I knew I studied this company so I could learn, okay, I'm going to tell them facts about the company when I talk to the guys. So, you know, this is my manipulation tactics. You know, I learned all about the company. I learned about the revenue. I learned where they were selling cotton, you know, all this stuff. And when I talked to the guy, you know, I just wowed him. And then he said, hey, you know, we did this project in marketing. He wanted to know about sustainability, you know. And so I did all this. I was, of course, I was the group leader for our group. And, you know, after the project was over, I got a call, and he said, hey, you know, this is Greg Paul from San Joaquin Valley Quality Cotton Growers Association. You want to come down and expand upon the work that you started there? I said, yeah. You know, and so I did that, and I got my foot in the door, and I grew my ego. I grew, you know, I changed my persona completely. You know, from younger, I was the number one hardest dude on the block, you know, to transitioning to a business professional. What the hell is that? You know, that's crazy. So I did all this, and I started getting involved in the community, and I just got batshit crazy. I started drinking more, and I started getting involved with nonprofit organizations. I was getting on this board, that board, and I was the president of this, president of that. Don't you know who the fuck I am? You know, just out of control. I started going to these conferences and getting just drunk for a week straight. We went to New York on a school project, and I think we were there for a week, and we slept for like 8 hours the whole time. We were just, I mean, I was like puking in the bathroom of Morgan Stanley at the main office, you know, and just nuts, you know, and I was out of control, and I had no idea why, you know, I didn't know what was happening, you know, and I had the job, you know, I finished school, I was making good money, we had nice cars, we went in with, I went in, my wife and I with our in-laws, we bought a ranch, you know, we're farmers now. You know, everything that I wanted, you know, we had it. And after we moved to the ranch, you know, it wasn't like 2 months before I was fired from my job, you know, and I was gone. And I was back in the streets with gun in my pocket, gun in the back of my car, doing crazy shit, you know, just gone. And I was like, how the hell did this happen, you know? And you know, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, I got arrested, and this is how crazy I am. I get arrested for one bullet in my vehicle from an ex-felon. So I bail out and go to my next court hearing, and they didn't pick up the charges. You know, they exonerated my bail. And that was the sign to me that, hey, you really are untouchable, you know? They got you, and they let you go, you know? And I just continued, and then eventually, you know, it all caught up to me, you know? And so I'm, you know, I should have went to jail for a long time. You know, my wife really intervened on my behalf. You know, we had an attorney. And she put together all these materials, and, you know, the judge just ended up giving me a chance, you know, and he put me in a program for, and I ended up at Pine again. And then I recall the first meeting, well, one of the first meetings that we went to, Saturday night meeting at the Carpenter's Hall. And I walk in there with all the rest of the shout-out guys at Pine. And there's a whole bunch of just white-haired dudes and ladies sitting, you know, in the seats and stuff. And I'm thinking, oh, here we go, you know. And in retrospect, it was like Ed and all these guys that I know now were the ones that were these light-haired people. And there was this long-haired guy, the cowboy hat on and glasses, and the trench coat sitting there. And I'm thinking, shit, you know, this nigga's going to suck, you know. And he tells my story to the T. And I was like, holy shit, man. So I get up. You know, at the end of the meeting, he's like, man, you told my story. Can I get your number? And he's like, sure, I'm boss. And he gave me his number, you know. And I never fucking called him. You know, and like, a couple days later, we're at the Lano Club. And there's this guy, and he's talking. He's got his big book. And he says, relapse. I've never seen anybody relapse in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he throws his book down like that, and everybody, all the people in Pine are like, this guy's bullshit, you know. And I have my little spidey senses tingling, you know, like, what's this guy talking about, you know. And he says, well, let me explain myself. He says, I've never seen one person come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, get a sponsor, pick up this book, and do everything that they're supposed to do with that sponsor to the best of their ability. I'm not seeing one person do that and relapse. And it was like, you know, I've been conning, manipulating, doing everything possible that I could do to get away with stuff my whole entire life. You know, I'm going to give this a shot. So I go up and I ask the guy, hey, will you be my sponsor? Well, you got to be willing to do the work. So, okay. And so, you know, I did it, you know. I, for the first time in my life, you know, even through college, when I was little, my dad, one of the tenets he beat into us was, don't half-ass anything. You're going to half-ass it, don't even do it at all, you know. And so, one time I said, okay, well, I'm not going to do it, you know. It didn't work out. But, you know, I got into this mindset that everything I do, I need to full-ass it. Well, the problem is that everything that I full-assed was all the bad shit, you know. You know, I'm luckily I'm a little intelligent, so I pick things up, you know, processes, and you know, I did checks, and I was really good at that. I did all kinds of just high tech shit, you know. And I was really good at it. But anything positive for myself, I never did to the best of my ability. Not even college, you know. I mean, I graduated and I had a really high GPA, but I didn't do any work. You know, I scammed and manipulated the whole time too. You know, so I meet with this guy for the first time. He gives me an assignment. He says, when are you going to have it done? So, okay, I'll have it done by this date. And I'm good with deadlines and assignments. So I write this out. You know that movie, Christmas Story? Shoot your eye out, kid. Well, he has this assignment to write this theme about what he wants for Christmas. And he's sitting there fantasizing about how the teacher receives his theme. And she reads it, and she's like, oh, my God, this is the best theme in the world. And she's writing on the board, A, plus, plus. And she's, like, going off, and she's plusing all across the room, like down the wall and stuff. You know, and I have this, there I am, you know, I'm in my mind again, like I've been my whole life imagining how this interaction is going to play out. You know, I'm just thinking, man, he's going to see this and he's going to be like, damn, you're good, you know. And he gets it and he's like, what's this garbage? What are you talking about? Don't you know that I got my master's, I graduated 3.96 GPA? What the hell are you talking about? Garbage, you know. That's a real written proposal, you know. Well, you know, he does this. He says I in here 48 times, and, you know, I allowed alcohol to do this, and I allowed alcohol to do that. He said, this isn't about you being powerless. This is a statement of how powerful you are over alcohol. I was like, wow, you know, I didn't ever look at it that way. He said, and he taught me that, you know, when I had, you know, I was smoking. Well, I was doing stuff that we don't discuss here in David Valadeo's bathroom, you know, at his office, you know. I had that meeting that I had to do, but I still got loaded. You know, my boys, one of my sons was having a hard time, and, I was banned from my kids for a long time, and it finally got back to where I had my kids in my life again, And they sent him down to live with us for the summer, I got loaded and I was gone. I couldn't help it, this is terrible, I knew that my wife was at home waiting for me. I hadn't been home in a month. I knew that she was sitting on the porch with a blanket praying that that was going to be the night that I was coming home. I got loaded anyway, When I know that something has to get done, I still get loaded, I still drink. I still take that because I'm powerless over it, I learned that as a result of that, everything, well, it was quite obvious that, my life was unmanageable. And I went through and I did the steps, and he helped me to find a God of my understanding, to identify those traits and to find one that I could say, okay, when I'm praying, I know that this is going to help me, because when I use my will, everything goes to shit, If I was in my will, I'd be driving some big old Escalade, shooting at people every day and doing whatever the hell I want, And that's not real because I'd be dead. I should be dead. Leading up to this, in like the 6 or 7 months before I got sober, I totaled 5 new cars. 2 within 2 days of each other. I came to, so I recall kind of here and there events of the day, I was in Seville doing something I shouldn't have been doing, picking something up. And I remember kind of being at Wood Lake and dropping something off. And then next thing I open my eyes and I see blue sky, and this Challenger has no more top. And I just click my button, my seatbelt, and I walk out of the hole. And I look back. And there's this tractor trailer that's missing the whole back axle. I went underneath it, made a new car into a convertible. I didn't even know what was going on. It's just, my life is so different today, as a result of, getting a sponsor, working the steps. And it didn't work out with that sponsor. I did everything the best of my ability. Did a 4-step, really thorough. I said, oh man, it's not coming to me. I don't know what. He said, you're just bullshitting. You're not willing to dig. I want you to dig. Got to move mountains. We got to bring a shovel. So I dug, and I had like 120 something resentments alone, and it was like 70 pages by the time I was done. My 4-step, and I did everything. I did the, was ready to have all the stuff removed, made men's cards, did all that stuff, And after 12 step, this guy kind of went off the rails on me, And, oh, Clare County, so watered down, AA, I'm not even going to go to meetings anymore because it's so watered down. It's not like the meetings were in Texas and this and that, And he's like, you have to have external psychic change. And one of the things I feel is your psychic change is you need to start going to gym. You need to lose like 40 pounds in the next few months. And I'm like, what? I'm willing to go any length. But, and he was just off the rails. And I just, I can't do it no more. And so I ran into that number, for that guy I never called. I ended up calling him and said, hey, you working for me? And, he encouraged me, yeah. But you gotta, meet with me once a week. You gotta do the work. You gotta get the, we gotta go through the book. You gotta start working with other people, And I latched onto that and I did that, And I'm doing that today. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the preamble it says that, achieve sobriety and help others recover from alcoholism, And so I was at the point where I had achieved some sobriety, And then what really changed my life for the best was, you know, I started working with other people. You know, vigorous work with other alcoholics. You know, and that's what has really saved my life. I do a lot of, you know, I work with a lot of guys, and, you know, if some of them are here tonight, and I think it's awesome. You know, I when you go to a speaker meeting and he's really killing it, and you're all pumped up, and you're like, yeah, hey, shit, yeah, you know. That's how I feel whenever I work with these guys, you know, whenever we're in this book, you know, and like, you know, oh, man, that bitter morass is, you know, that bitter morass is self-pity and depression, quicksand, sets you right in from all directions, you know, and it's just done, you know. I've felt that, you know, we've all felt that when you see that connection, you know, and then we're able to say, hey, you know, after that, things got better, you know, and just that light when it comes on, it just, you know, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing that compares to being able to work with someone and help them to grow, you know, because that's, you know, that's what was done for me, you know, someone just, some lifetime criminal lowlife who, you know, who thought he was somebody, but really was just a drunk ass junkie, I guess, you know. Oh. Jeez. Third time's a charm. You know, I remember Derek Toon, you know, I got out of Pine and I was going to this meeting. And I stuck around this meeting, and I started making coffee at it. And I remember one night we were there, and he's like, "Man, I didn't think this guy was gonna make it, but he's still here." And it was like 16 months after, you know. And I was like, "Man, that's a good compliment, you know." You know, I'll wrap it up here real quick, but I wanted to share something. I know you guys have already read this, probably, and if you haven't, then this is like my favorite stuff right here. 84, you know, right after Promises, says, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky, nor are we afraid of it. That is our experience. That is how we react as long as we keep in fit spiritual condition." You know, that's, you know, at one point I read that and I was like, that's what I want, you know, and that's what I have today, you know. It doesn't, I mean, I don't, like I said, I'm not feeling cocky or anything about it. Just the fact of the matter, you know, it, as long as I maintain that fit spiritual condition, you know, I could do anything in the world, you know, and I don't have to be in fear that, oh man, the wheel's going to fall off of this car and I'm going to end up drunk and jail again, you know. And what's the, if that's, you know, that's what I want to keep every day of this life. You know, if I'm 20 years sober and my recovery is so shaky that I'm just hanging on for dear life, it's like, what's the fucking point, you know? I don't want to live my life just afraid to go outside because I think I'm going to slip and fall and land on a bottle of Jack or something, you know? I want that, you know? And how do I get that? You know, do the work, you know, do the steps, get a sponsor, help others, you know, just keep fit spiritual condition, you know. Now I've just been blessed beyond all that I can say, you know. I mean, just the physical things, you know, I've got way more than I ever had before, you know. My, got a better job, pays better, right? Just everything like that is great. But I could have nothing, and I am content. I'm happy. I love my life today, you know? And I can't imagine going back to the way it was before, you know? I can't imagine not working with these guys. You know, I can't imagine coming to my house, having dinner with those, doing the steps, you know, reading the book. I can't imagine life without that. You know, I can't imagine life without going to the meetings and, you know, being able to, you know, my family on my side, pretty much other than my dad, none of them want anything to do with me, you know. I can't even, you know, my boys, haven't seen them in over 3 years. And, you know, my sister, you know, she has them. And, you know, it's like, when it all happened, they say, oh, you're never going to see them again, you know. And I understand that, you know, I just got to trust God's will, you know. One last thing, and I'll wrap it up. So, you know, I've seen the promises with my life. You know, things that would normally cause me great angst and just stress and everything. You know, Monday night, I was at the men's stag meeting. I get a message from my wife, you know. And she says, oh, oh, I'm getting dramatic here. But she, in her text, she communicates to me that she's in contact with GEICO, looking for, you know, a policy for us, and they inform her that my license is suspended. And normally, you know, if I hadn't been living this, you know, spiritual-centered life, I'd have said, okay, God, you know, all right, I'll let you, you know, we'll figure it out. You know, I'm going to trust that you know what's going on. You know, and I said, okay, well, we'll check it out when I get home. You know, I got home, got on the DMV website, pulled my, you know, pulled my driving report, and I learned that I had been driving on a suspended license for the last 3 years. Not been pulled over. Nothing. You know? And that's God right there in itself, you know? I didn't freak out. I wasn't trying to call someone and chew them out at, you know, 10 o'clock at night when I got home from the meeting. So, okay, you know? All right, God, you got this, you know? And it was just something stupid. You know, I had the, we searched through all this stuff, and we found the letter, says your life, because, you know, I accept the fact that, you know, I totaled 5 cars in 6 months, you know, and I got the letter and said, hey, you're a bad driver, come meet us, you know. And I went and talked to the guy, and he's like, whoa, what happened here? Well, yeah, and I kind of like him and hawed through it, you know, because I didn't, when I say it, I was just loaded, and I don't know really what happened. But, you know, I got the letter in the mail, and it said, oh, from April 13th, 2016, your license is not good. And June 12th, 2016, your license is back on. The guy said, yeah, okay, you know, it's gone for this time. Well, they forgot to turn it on, you know. And it wasn't that big of a deal. I went to the DMV, and my wife came and met me, and it was a little like, nobody enjoys going to see the DMV for a couple hours, but it wasn't that big of a deal, you know? And I didn't have to freak out about it. I didn't have to call Sacramento. You know, I didn't have to talk to the supervisors, you know? I didn't have to do any of that shit. I just said, okay, God, you know, I'm going to let you, you know, things that used to baffle us, you know, we're able to face them, you know. Those promises are real, and they're, I see them every day in my life, you know. And if it wasn't for all of you, my new family, you know, in this program, I wouldn't have any of it, you know. I'm just really grateful for everybody here, and that's all I got. Thank you.
Thanks, Lord.